All right, y'all. How the hell are you? Good, good. Well, all right. I'm doing okay, too. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. Mostly the chip on my shoulder is foreign policy related, but also hate some cops and the rest of the state. Promote libertarianism as much as I can, but mostly by example. Yeah, that's it. And it's interesting to note, not that everything would be utopian perfect or anything, but it is interesting to note that all the worst things happening in the world are the U.S. government's fault right now. And no, I'm not talking about whichever team lost the soccer game everybody's crying about. I'm talking about Palestine and Iraq, of course. What's going on in Israel is the responsibility of Barack Obama more than anyone else in the world, more than Benjamin Netanyahu, more than any of the traitors in the U.S. Congress, Rand Paul, more than any of them. The buck stops in the Oval Office at the desk of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces and the Chief Executive of the United States Federal Government's Executive Branch. You know, there's a story. Was it from Reagan's memoirs or who brought this up? I don't know. I just thought of it or else I would have the footnote ready for you. But anyway, you could double check me. Where Ronald Reagan made a phone call to Menachem Begin and said, hey, stop bombing Beirut right now. And then, blam, they stopped bombing him in 5 minutes. That was it. The last four bombs fell and the damn thing was over. And that Reagan turned to whoever on his national security staff and said, hey, I didn't know I could do that. Yeah, of course you can do that. If anybody could have done it, it would have been Ronald Reagan, for crying out loud. But any American president could just give a speech called, I'm sick and tired of the prime minister's bull, aren't you, Americans? And it would be over for the right-wing nationalist expansionists in the Israeli government. You want your endless vetoes in the UN Security Council and your free money and your free weapons to subsidize all your crimes against innocent people from now on? Sorry, no. It is now hereby, beginning with this speech, the official policy of the U.S. government that the Israeli government can go to hell. We are not going to pay you to kill innocent people anymore. Get the hell out of the West Bank yesterday. Lift the siege of the Gaza Strip immediately. And then, you know, East Jerusalem, out of East Jerusalem. Anyway, everybody knows the deal. And the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And the occupation. And any president could make that happen with a single speech. Any president could make that happen just by turning the American people against Israel. And all he would have to do, or she, would have to do would be to tell the American people the honest truth. Hell, get like Ross Perot with your visual aids. Show them a map. See, this is Israel right here. This is the occupied territory where the Palestinians live under the rule of the foreign Israeli government's martial law, military, and domestic police state. So you see right there, this part is the thing that's causing the problem. This is what animated Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker on 9/11, to attack the United States of America. And so it's time for this occupation to end. Don't you think, America? And that would be it. So it's all Barack Obama's fault. That's it. It's all his fault. It's 100% his responsibility. Who was it I just interviewed the other day and I let it go, but somebody just said something about, or maybe it was an article I read. I can't keep it straight in my brain anymore. It all gels together. I don't know. But somebody was saying, yeah, Obama really thought that he was just going to send John Kerry and they were going to get some peace deal. That may have even been something that Phil Weiss or Max Blumenthal said or something. I don't know. Maybe Phil Weiss said it. I don't know. But if he did, then he's a completely ridiculous idiot. If he thought that he was just going to send Kerry over there and he was going to have some kind of success in having both sides come to the table on this thing without major pressure, without something like a speech from the Oval Office to the American people about why this is important for our national security. As David Petraeus testified under oath before the Senate a few years back, my guys are dying because of what Israel's doing in Palestine. Oh, he apologized. He accidentally forwarded an email exchange with Max Boot, the neocon from the Council on Foreign Relations, to James Morris, an anti-Zionist activist, where he's telling Max Boot, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to tell the truth about that and make Israel look bad. I had dinner with Eli Wiesel the other night. Would you please tell everybody to not be mad at me? David Petraeus, ass-kissing little chicken sht. That's what Admiral Fallon called him. Proven in spades in his email to Max Boot. That's all published at MondoWeiss.com if you want to look it up and laugh your ass off, by the way. David Petraeus, the four-star general. I mean, admittedly, he's the lowest scum of the earth who lost two wars, which is pretty exceptional. But still, four-star general groveling before Max Boot. Please tell everybody I didn't mean to tell the truth about how American support for Israel costs security. American security in the Middle Eastern region. This is at a time where American troops were dying in Iraq. In Afghanistan. Anyway, so there you go. It's all Barack Obama's fault, just like it was all George W. Bush's fault. You know, Colin Powell came to George W. Bush and said, man, you've got more political capital right now after the greatest failure in the history of the world and to prevent this attack. You have so much political capital now. The blind faith that the American people have put in you, you can do anything you want. And something that's really, really important for protecting us from terrorism and something that takes a lot of political capital is getting the Israelis out of the West Bank, ending the occupation. The two-state solution. We've got to do this, Mr. President. And I know that Dick Cheney doesn't agree and whatever, but seriously, man, this is really important. And so George W. Bush started talking like that right after September 11th. We got to come to peace in the Middle East. It's important for our security. This, that, and the other thing. But then the neocons allied with Tom DeLay, or wasn't it Tom DeLay? Yeah, came to town, the Mr. Bug Exterminator, went over to the White House, and had a meeting with Bush and said, remember what happened to your father, where the evangelical right wing refused to come out to support him because of his hard line on the Israelis. And we'll do the same thing for you, and you'll be a one-term president. Because your name is Bush, after all, and all of that. And Bush backed down to Tom DeLay and to John Hagee, to Ariel Sharon. And said, all right, screw it. True story. In fact, I believe at least part of that is told in the Israel lobby by Mir Shimer and Walt. But you might even remember, right, from 2001, remember Colin Powell saying to Bush, now's our chance to resolve this terrible, outstanding issue? And then they didn't. Oh, then they said, the neocons said, you know what, though, peace in Palestine, the road to peace in Palestine runs through Baghdad. Yeah, see, once you do the Iraq war, then we'll have peace in Palestine. I mean, once you do the Iran war, once you do the regime change in Syria, once you get rid of Gaddafi for us, once you put the entire Pentagon directly under the command of the Prime Minister of Israel's office, then we'll have peace in Palestine. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, a little discharge for you there.
Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. Hey, join up the chat room. Got a few people in there. Hey, chat room guys, how the hell are you? It's scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need to have XChat or Pigeon or Chatzilla or any of that kind of crap. You can just open up in a plain old browser window, put in a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and there you go. scotthorton.org/chat. Coming up on the show, I should have said at the beginning, but I just got to ranting and raving about the damned president. Diana Bhutu. She is the something or other at the Institute for Middle East Understanding. She looks kind of familiar. I wonder, have I ever interviewed her before? I don't guess I have. Sort of seems familiar, like I've seen this headshot thing of her before, but I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. She's a former legal advisor to Palestinian negotiators, and she's a fellow at Harvard. And so here she is. She's going to tell the Palestinian side of the story that you never get to hear on talk radio anyway. I don't know where you get to hear it. In writing on the internet, if you look for it. So she's a lawyer and an analyst and a former Palestinian negotiator. And I didn't see it, but I heard she was kicking ass on CNN. And that's news in itself that CNN is even trying to let Palestinians have their say on this issue at all. It's amazing. It's unprecedented. So that'll be part of the interview too, I think. And then Eric Margolies is going to be on. To talk about Iraq. So that'll be great. That'd be horrible. I mean, Eric's good, but the subject is just, it's a mess. All right. And you know what? Also, you know what I'm going to do? I should remember this, man. I put a big circle around it so I don't forget. At some point in today's show, I think I'm going to replay the interview of Max Blumenthal that I got last night. I interviewed Dan Sanchez from the Mises Institute, which was great. But then I talked with Max Blumenthal about what's going on in Israel-Palestine and the kidnapping of the three kids and how the Israeli government, how the Israeli government kept that a secret for 2 weeks and exploited their death, kept their death a secret for 2 weeks, exploited the fact that they were missing and held out all this hope to just drum up this support so that then they could do this attack on Hamas and So the thing is that, yeah, man, it was just great. And he wrote this great thing. In fact, I guess that's what I'm going to talk about right now. We're going to talk about Iraq later on in the show. We're going to talk about the new NSA story later on in the show as well. But right now, in the top headlines on antiwar.com, you'll find this article, Netanyahu government knew teens were dead 2 weeks ago. And it's Max Blumenthal at the Electronic Intifada, electronicintifada.net. And Netanyahu government knew teens were dead as it whipped up a racist frenzy. And we now have, nightly, gangs of kooks going out protesting against the existence of the Arabs on the West Bank. Death to the Arabs, they chant. There's video on MondoWeiss.com of mobs opening up people's car doors to check their ethnicity. and you know, harassing them and messing them up. One teenager was lynched. And I hadn't realized this. Richard Silverstein blogged about it. It was only in the Hebrew Haaretz that they made him drink gasoline before they burned him to death. They can tell because of how badly his insides were charred, of course. So that was his lynching, like something straight out of the Old South right there, huh? I mean, the not-too-old South, but the before-I-was-born South. And then it was the cops that beat his cousin unconscious. Could have killed him. But they were on tape. And CNN, it's funny because CNN, they put out a tweet. Oh, gee, you know, the people beating up this kid, they're wearing Israeli police uniforms. Just trying to leave open the possibility that somehow they're not Israeli cops, even though everybody knows the kid was taken to jail and booked. He was arrested and booked by Israeli cops. They're wearing cop uniforms because they're cops. What are you trying to say? Same time, they turn around, and Jake Tapper did a pretty stern interview. It wasn't perfect, I don't know. But Jake Tapper, an actual reporter on CNN, not just an anchor, but an actual journalist on CNN, unlike somebody like, say, Wolf Blitzer or Christian Amanpour. I know she poses as a journalist, but she's a lot more of a hairdo, if you ask me. But anyway, Tapper took it to the, I don't know if he was the Israeli ambassador or some spokesman or whatever, and said, hey, you know, this is coming to our attention because this is a young Palestinian American. He was over there on vacation that this happened to, but you know, we're hearing from the human rights groups that this is how you guys treat Palestinians on a daily basis. Wow. Obviously, that is a true fact. Anyone who cares to learn about it knows. But for that to come out, especially as the basis for a kind of argumentative follow-up question on CNN, that's unprecedented in the history of the world. Israeli cruelty to their Palestinian helots that they occupy as a matter of policy, or at least as a de facto matter of policy, as a regular occurrence. And the poor spokesman, oh, geez. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. We got the rule of law like you Americans in the West. Oh, no. Not like the Americans. I got news for you, dude. The Americans, we got no rule of law. Not that bounds our government. I mean, our government sure does bound us by law all damn day. No doubt about that. But the rule of it, like the rules agreed upon beforehand, are the ones that count, not what the people with the power want. Yeah, right. Yes, I'm sure that the average Joe Schmo Palestinian occupied helot on the West Bank with no rights whatsoever has total accountability in the courts against any Shin Bet abuses upon him or his family, any army abuses upon him or his family. Isn't that what we all believe? This is why they don't talk about this stuff on CNN, because it's ridiculous on its face. No one believe that. It's better left just omitted. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Diana Butu. And she is from IMEU.org. That's the Institute for Middle East Understanding. She is a lawyer and analyst there. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Thank you very much for joining us today. So I guess my first question for you would be in regards to the media coverage. You've been on CNN lately, and I didn't see it, but I have it on good authority that they let you talk for 15 minutes or something and really explain what's going on over there in Israel and Palestine from a Palestinian point of view. And I was thinking that that's unique in the history of the world. And I wonder, I guess, first of all, you know, whether you think that's significant, whether that signifies some kind of real change in American media coverage of the issue. And then if so, why?
Well, actually, I have to disagree that CNN gave me some time to make the case. It's always actually quite the opposite. CNN seems to give an incredible amount of time to hearing Israel's version and Israel's lies when it comes to what's going on, what it is doing to Palestine, to the Palestinians. And as a Palestinian, it's always an uphill battle to even get your voice heard on mainstream media. The main problem, once it is on mainstream media, is that it then turns into a long debate about who is right and who is wrong. And it's as though the two sides are somehow equal. Whereas if you actually understand what's going on in Palestine, you will understand that this is the equivalent of the South African struggle. There are people who are fighting against apartheid, the Palestinians, and people who are intent on making sure that that apartheid remains in place, the Israelis. And to somehow equate as though they have some type of moral equivalence is incorrect. And also, this is one of the battles that we end up fighting all the time on mainstream media, is that they kind of make it out to be the same when there really isn't a parity between the two sides.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that you're starting out in a situation where they've never told the Palestinian side of the story at all. So if they do give you a few minutes, I mean, that is like a daybreak or sun coming out after the rain or something like that, even if they give you just a minute. I guess the way it was described to me was they were sort of going through the Israeli narrative and letting you respond to it, at least in a fashion that the person, my friend and boss, who was I was talking about with this, he had never seen that much openness for discussion on CNN ever. I guess one time the Queen of Jordan and Pat Buchanan were allowed to explain the Palestinian point of view on MSNBC for about 10 minutes 6 years ago, something like that. But otherwise, we just don't see this at all.
Right. This is a major problem, particularly given the fact that the United States is such a player in this issue, and the fact that the United States continues to give Israel over $3 billion in U.S. taxpayer money every year. One would expect that given this relationship and this link, that you would at the very least hear where U.S. Taxpayer dollars are going and how they're being spent to drop bombs on children, quite frankly. But instead, this is an issue that doesn't seem to be covered in mainstream media unless there are Israelis who end up losing their lives.
Right. Well, you know, in the Jake Tapper interview the other day where he was talking with some Israeli spokesman, I guess, and was saying, well, you know, this beating of this young Palestinian American, which we have on video, and he's an American, so we're covering it. We're hearing from the human rights groups that this is how you treat Palestinians all the time. What about that? And he says, no, there's the rule of law. We're like the West with the rule of law, like you guys and all this stuff, which I'm not really bragging about the rule of law in America or anything. But I just thought it was kind of silly. And I think this goes to show exactly why they don't really cover this, is because if they tell the truth about it at all, or I guess if they have to even confront the real challenges to their claims at all, they obviously fall apart. Who thinks that the average Joe on the West Bank has the right, has any accountability whatsoever when it comes to being mistreated by the Shin Bet or the IDF ever, or whatever happens to their property, to their families? There's no accountability. They're under occupation. Everybody knows that. There's nothing like the rule of law. There's a rule of law like there was a rule of law for the average citizen of Baghdad circa 2006.
Yes, and I think it's actually even a little bit deeper than that. We are in the West Bank talking about a system of military law. So given that it's military law, it's not going under a regular court system. And what this means is that people can be held without charge, without trial, in secret evidence for 6 months, and that detention can be renewed. There are people who are still remain in administrative detention 8 years after the fact that they still have no charges even filed against them. When it comes to this, the issue of this 15-year-old boy, American boy, who was beaten, his story is the story of many other Palestinian children. Right now, there are 200 Palestinian children who are languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them also being held without charge, without trial. There is a long line of cases dealing with children who are tortured by the Israeli security system. And even not just, it's not just a question of the army carrying out these acts, but also the Israeli settler population has similarly done things and carried out acts with impunity. There are 90% of the cases that are 90% of the cases that are filed with the police against Israeli settler activity end up going without even a simple indictment. And those that are indicted, very few of them actually end up resulting in a conviction. And in many cases, those convictions are often lead to very light sentences. So this is the type of system, or the quote unquote rule of law, that Mr. Regev is talking about. There's one set of laws for Israelis and another set of military laws that are applicable for Palestinians. It's a joke for anybody to think that this is the equivalent of any democratic system around the world.
All right, now, one thing is that the kind of unthinkable seems to regular people to be impossible, usually. Come on, who tortures children as a matter of state policy? And I already know you're right about this because I've read about this before, but I'd like to give you a chance to, cite some sources or tell the audience how they can find the proof for themselves that that really is true, that the Shin Bet tortures Palestinian children.
Absolutely. There are many, many reports that you can be turning to. There's organizations, such international organizations like the Defense for Children International, which has an office based in Palestine, and they document these issues. You can also check out the Damir, which is a Palestinian prisoner rights organization, which also documents this. The United Nations has similarly documented this. When it comes to the issue of settler violence, the United Nations has written reports. Israeli human rights organizations like Yesh Din and B'Tselem have also written reports. Palestinian organizations like Al-Haq have also written reports. All of these reports are fully document the situation that is taking place here. There is no shortage of documentation. The big problem is that as a Palestinian living under military occupation, you're always up against this very big, very strong media machine that goes out of its way to deny the human rights abuses that it is perpetrating. And it denies them not only to an international audience, but to a domestic audience. This is why, Scott, when talking about this issue, this isn't simply confined to the West Bank, the attacks that Israel carries out against the West Bank, people in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. There's an entire a system of racism that pervades this area,
Right.
where
All right.
it's
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're going to get right back to that all-pervasive system, the totalitarianism of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip siege and all of that, right after this break. It's Diana Buttu from the IMEU.org, IMEU.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Diana Buttu from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. That's IMEU.org, the Institute for Middle East Understanding. And I'm sorry about the hard breaks programmed in here. No way around it. Got to take them. But when we were interrupted, you were saying that it's not just that there's an occupation in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem. It's the all-pervasive system of being interrupted by commercials. So go ahead from there, please, if you would.
Yes, in addition to the commercials, it's the fact that Palestinians for 66 years have simply not been free. Right now, you know, there's this pervasive system in Israel itself in which Palestinians are deemed to be legitimate targets. Everybody from the prime minister, the Israeli prime minister, has called for bloodletting and for revenge. The foreign minister, who supposedly represents all of the citizens of this country, has called Palestinians who are citizens of Israel a fifth column and has called for their expulsion, their ethnic cleansing from the country. And so living in this climate, it's unsurprising that there is so much violence that is perpetrated against Palestinians because it is allowed to go unchecked by the state.
I get the idea, and I don't know how much time you spend actually in Israel, but I get the idea from Max Blumenthal's writings and I guess from some things that Phil Weiss has said in that documentary movie, Defamation. It sort of seems like it's always America 2002 in Israel. It's always the terrorists, Orange Alert, the terrorists coming to get us. And it really is, you know, in majority, I guess, a society where people are convinced that the Palestinians are the aggressors. And they don't ask the question who's occupying whom. They're just looking at terrible Arab Muslims keep attacking us. Who can keep them at bay? And they really believe that crap, like Americans in 2002.
Yes, I mean, I am a citizen of Israel. I'm a Palestinian, but I have Israeli citizenship. Okay. And so I understand exactly what you're talking about. It's worse than that. It's not just a question of this constant state of fear that the Israelis are instilling in their own mindset. It's it goes beyond that. It's that Palestinians are considered to be legitimate targets, and B, that Palestinian rights actually don't exist. The state goes very much out of its way to deny that Palestinians are the original inhabitants of the country. They deny things like the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. We can't even, up until a certain point, we weren't even able to educate our own students about these about this issue. And to this day, organizations that try to educate Palestinians and others about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine are ineligible to receive state funding from the state. So it goes beyond just this conditioning of scare tactics towards Israelis, but it actually goes right to the very core where Palestinians are not allowed to have their own identity.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, I mean, mostly what I've learned my whole life about the Jim Crow South and, you know, post-slavery South that, well, like Jefferson put it, we have the wolf by the ears and all that, so we got to keep them down or else they might rise up. And so it's just state-sanctioned second, third, fourth-class citizenship for the others among us.
That's precisely the case. As it stands, there are about 40 laws, 40 to 50 laws officially on the books that either directly or indirectly discriminate against Palestinians who are citizens of the country. It's everything from the inability of Palestinians to immigrate to the country, whereas anybody who's Jewish from anywhere around the world is given unfettered access and unfettered right to immigrate to Israel, to other things where there's discrimination in housing, open discrimination in housing, where committees can decide whether you are considered suitable or not suitable to be able to live within that community. There's been, in terms of state funding, a lot less money allocated to Palestinian schools, less money allocated to Palestinian towns and cities. And since 1948, there hasn't even been the construction or the expansion of a single Palestinian town in the entire country. All of the new towns that are created are only towns designed for Jewish Israelis and nothing designed for Palestinians. So the discrimination is pervasive. Add to that the statements that officials make, whether it's the prime minister or, as I said, the foreign minister, who openly calls for the ethnic cleansing of the original inhabitants of the country, you can see the environment in which we live.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really incredible. And again, like you said at the beginning, all with U.S. support. And I forget if you framed it this way or not, but I certainly would, only with U.S. support. Otherwise, this would not continue. It couldn't.
That's precisely the case. It's U.S. financial support and it's U.S. political support, and then the trickle-down effect that ensues of European financial support and European political support. All of this would not be possible were it not for the fact that the United States continues to maintain very close ties and continues to enable Israel's very bad behavior.
All right, and speaking of which, can you please catch us up on all the bad news out of the West Bank and Gaza from, you know, I guess just the last 4 or 5 days, the attacks, since the airstrikes on Gaza began and the riots in the streets of Tel Aviv, everybody chanting death to the Arabs and all that kind of madness?
Yes, we've had, it's been a very difficult time for Palestinians here. The Israeli army launched a bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip the day before yesterday. So far, there have been 35 Palestinians killed. Many of them are children. Two whole families were completely wiped out. The Israeli army admits that it's dropped 400 tons of bombs in, over the Gaza Strip, more than the entire period of their bombing campaign in 2012. Entire homes have been flattened. And it's important to keep in mind that this is an area that is completely under Israeli military control. There's no place for people to go. They don't have bomb shelters. They don't have sirens. There's no place for them to go whatsoever. All of the land crossings, one land crossing is controlled by the Egyptians and the other land crossing is controlled by the Israelis. There's no place for these people to go. 80% of the Gaza Strip are refugees. And 20% of this population is are under the age of 3. So we're talking about bombs that are being dropped on children's heads. In the West Bank, there's been a system of collective punishment that's been in place now for well over 3 weeks, with 12 Palestinians killed in the West Bank as the Israelis went around searching for three Israelis who had gone missing and were later killed, even though they knew that they had already been killed. 500 Palestinians have been arrested. 2,000 homes have been ransacked. A few homes have been wholesale destroyed because they were considered to be suspects. And we're seeing lynchings taking place in East Jerusalem, including a young boy who was kidnapped, tortured by being forced to drink gasoline, and then he was set on fire, his body set on fire. So the situation for Palestinians is quite a grave one, and it leads me and others to ask the question, who is here protecting Palestinians?
Yeah, it's yes. Just incredible, especially the lynching and the story. We talked with Max Blumenthal before about the how they knew. They just lied, pretended that they were looking for these kids as they're ransacking all these West Bank homes and inciting all this hatred on the idea that they were still alive somewhere, when in fact they already knew that they were dead. It's really amazing. Well, and so I guess let me ask you, now that nobody's even pretending two-state solution, peace talks, peace process, Oslo, Annapolis, blah, blah, blah thing anymore, what is the future for Palestine?
The future, I think, is that the only way to move forward is Israel has to be held to account for its international law violations and for its violations of human rights. I think that we as citizens, global citizens, have to really be pushing for Israel's isolation around the world, whether that's in the form of boycotts or divestment or sanctions or complete isolation. This is something that needs to happen. I have very little faith in the United States moving, but I do have a lot of faith in the people around the world getting people to move. And I'm hoping that we begin to see some more activity as well within the United Nations to try to condemn Israel and to completely isolate it. If we simply allow this to continue as it is, then we're going to see a lot more Palestinians being killed because Israel has never been given a red light.
Yeah. And as we speak, they're at least threatening a full-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip, which, yes, could very well be imminent at this point. And on your last point there, I did see a thing on Vox. There's the music. I did see a thing on Vox that showed that all around the world, everyone agrees with you, except the American people who don't know the first thing about it. So we're working on that. But thank you very much for your time, Diane. It's really been great.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that is Diana Boutu. She's at the Institute for Middle East Understanding, IMEU.org, IMEU.org. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you kids. This here's my show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. She was great, wasn't she? This was Diana Boutu from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. And, you know, I don't know if it's her headshot or if it's the purple and green color scheme or what is it that feels so familiar about this site. You know, now I've decided I have to go and search my site for her name and see if she's ever been on there before. Let's see. You go site:scotthorton.org and then her name and then see what happens. Nothing. Nope. Okay. All right. I wonder if her institute, what is it? Institute for Middle East Understanding. Let's see if that's on there. IMEU. Did not match any documents. Huh. All right. Well, anyway, she's great, man. She's going, do I even have a Palestine list here? Yeah, I do, right here. Palestine list. Boutu. Yeah, man, she was cool, dude. And yeah, you see how she got right to the point at the very beginning there that what's not fair about giving equal time at all, even if they give equal time one time for a minute, not even equal, but just give anybody a chance, it still makes it a he said, she said kind of thing where the facts are not laid out, where here's what's indisputable. This country is jailing this country. Okay? It's not the country next door, it's the country under their jackboot. Those are the facts. Okay, now debate. We're still a long way from there on American TV, but I think people are getting it. And like I said, and I put this link in Justin's column here. Let me see if I can find it for you real quick, because it was a link to this Vox thing. International scale, that was it. If you go to Raimondo's column today, you can find this, the words international scale in red toward the bottom there. That's a link to this Vox story. How does the world feel about Israel-Palestine? Non-Muslim countries recognize Israel's legitimacy and maintain diplomatic relations with it, but most are harshly critical of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians and ongoing occupation of the West Bank. Global public opinion at present is assuredly more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. 83% of the world's countries, and almost every country that isn't Arab or Muslim majority, recognizes Israel. And so then they have their map, of course, since it's Vox, and they show those that have no diplomatic relationship, those that used to have a diplomatic relationship, and everybody else. So they're saying... Virtually every country in the world outside of the Muslim, so-called Muslim world, has a relationship with Israel, a perfectly normal one, on a nation-state basis, on a trade basis, etc. But the people of the entire planet Earth, they disagree vehemently with the occupation of Palestine. And the reason why is because they know the first thing about it. That's all. And the only people in America who I ever hear, you know, acknowledging the facts of it and saying, oh, well, so what, would be, you know, that land belongs to Israel, whatever, would be, hardcore right-wing Zionists. Although even the Likud party has renounced Greater Israel as an official policy. I mean, Netanyahu claims his policy still is two states. So, you know, it's you don't find that much sentiment for, yeah, just take it all, except for among the John Hagee religious kooks, the guys that say the Pope is the Antichrist, and they got to hurry up, make Jesus come back, and kill all the Jews so that all the Baptists can go to heaven. What in the stupid are you talking about? The Cornerstone Church down there in San Antonio. Do I have some Hagee clips here? I got some Hagee clips, man, don't I? Give me an H. I think Max Blumenthal got this clip.
I believe the Antichrist is alive and well. I believe he knows who he is, and I believe he awaits with glee his day of demonic reign. This man is at least going to be partially Jewish, as was Adolf Hitler, as was Karl Marx. He will not regard the desire of women. That means he's going to be homosexual.
There you go. So, there you have it. These are the Americans who understand the facts of what's going on with the occupation of the West Bank, but they're for it because they're trying to force Jesus' hand, because what's taking him so damn long when they want him to come and kill everyone? Who wants to die alone? Well, they want to see the whole world burn. Some people are just like that. And so they want to make sure that they get to see it when it's the end of the world. And so, but otherwise, I bet you, you take the average American and you explain to him, you do know, right, that Palestine isn't the country next door like Jordan or something like that. That it's a occupied, conquered, militarized territory, colonized territory of the Israelis. That they have occupied longer than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe. You know that, right? If you taught that to every American, they'd be against it. They would say, that's what we're backing over there? Hell, we thought we were helping Israel hold back the hordes, not hold down the people that they had conquered. Whatever happened to Fort Israel and all of this kind of crap, you know? It turns the whole lie upside down. That's what she was saying, too. It's not just the West Bank. It's the war against the very truth that the Palestinians are even from there, that the Nakba ever even happened, that Palestinians are individual human beings with property rights, that there's any limit to what can be done to them. It's horrible. It's wrong. And like I was saying on the show last week, and this ought to be the mantra for all of the pro-Palestinians, the anti-occupation forces on earth, is just trade the positions around for 1 minute and tell me how tolerable this would be if the Arab, Muslims, and Christians kept the Jews locked up in the concentration camp of the Gaza Strip prison under blockade and siege, hungry but not starving. On a diet, but not like we're trying to really kill them all. Tell me how tolerable that would be for them to just bulldoze all of the Jewish housing in West Jerusalem and build all of their, museums of tolerance on top of the cemeteries of the dead Jews. How tolerable that would be if the Palestinians were building giant settlements patrolled by vastly superior military forces in the heart of Israel, separating the Israelis from their property, from their crops, from their families, from their villages, putting them through endless, humiliating series of checkpoints everywhere they go. I mean, imagine the outrage. If they put a checkpoint, you can't get to Louisiana from Texas unless you have to stop and show your papers. And that's just to get from one state to another. We would, tell me, there's a line somewhere, right, where Americans ever get fed up with our own government? I don't know. So far, we've rejected those kind of internal checkpoints, even on a state-to-state basis in America. And I know the cameras and the license plate recognition are getting the job done de facto. But anyway, you understand my point I'm making. Imagine, really, if the Palestinians were putting the Jews through what the Jews are putting the Palestinians through over there. It's ridiculous. It would be absolutely intolerable. America would go to war. America would hire Egypt to invade or something, right? I mean, what are we talking about? So there you go. If it would be wrong for the Palestinians to do to the Israelis, then it's wrong for the Israelis to do to the Palestinians. You see how simple that is? It's just so simple when you put it that way. Because it is simple. It's wrong. And it's coming right out of your paycheck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. You know, I got a lot of other news to talk about, but god dang, I still feel like complaining about Israel, Palestine, and America issues some more here. Boy, I can't write and talk at the same time. I ought to practice that more. Hey, I'm Scott Horton, scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org. Advertise on the show if you want, scott@scotthorton.org. That's my email address. All right, so here's the thing, two things. First of all, have you ever seen the documentary Defamation? I mentioned it to her in that interview as part of my setup for the question about just how paranoid and insane is Israeli society at this point. And she confirmed that, oh yeah, really crazy. And the thing of it is that you should see this movie. It's made by an Israeli. He starts out in Israel, and then he travels to Europe, and he travels to the United States in search of anti-Semitism, as William F. Buckley might say. And, sorry, my mustache itches. Sometimes, even on a radio show, you gotta stop and itch your mustache. All right. So, the thing of it is, the way this filmmaker portrays it, anyway, is that Israel is a place of, society-wide, almost a psychosis of fear. And societies can go crazy sometimes. You've seen it in your own life and experience before. And they're just paranoid beyond all reason. And he talks about how the word Holocaust, Shoah, is in everything. It's the Shoah furniture blowout. It's the Shoah everything. In every newspaper, you'll find the word Shoah 1,000 times over again. And the message in virtually every political statement is that everyone who is not one of us is trying to kill us. And that's how the kids are raised to believe. And go watch the movie. Tell me if I get it wrong. If you've seen the movie, argue with me in the chat room or whatever you want. I don't know. Email me. Tweet me. But it seems to me like the message that Israeli children are brought up with is that everybody who's not Jewish only lives to try to kill Jews. That's the only reason who anyone is not one of us even gets up in the morning, is they're just looking for their chance to get us. Which is the dumbest lie in the whole world. I don't know how any, you might as well wake up believing that that's all the Jews wake up doing, is thinking about you. It's stupid. But it's, you know what? I mean, to me, and sorry, I'm an atheist, so I don't mean to offend you or whatever, but to me, it's just like believing in religion. It's like, hey, we're all agreeing to go along with this, right? Okay. Kind of a thing. There's got to be a lot of cognitive dissonance that goes along with it, but still we persist. That kind of thing, you know? And anyway, I think that, well, the reason I'm mentioning it is because it was important for my understanding. And she says, you know, it's even worse than America 2002. But anyway, I'm from America, so that's my analogy. 2002, the year Americans, and late 2001, of course, and a little while after that, anyway, a few years after that. But especially 2002 was a year where Americans decided that all cops and prosecutors and government employees of all kinds are the most wonderful people in the whole world. Conviction rates for every kind of crime went up to 99.999% from coast to coast. Hot ladies were screwing firemen and cops in every bar. And people were absolutely terrified that there are sleeper cells everywhere. As the scaremongers in and out of government never ceased to proclaim, orange alert, sleeper cell, Islamic terrorism. And since they never told the truth that, well, you know, we've been picking a fight over there for a long time, and come to think of it, we're actually pretty lucky that we've only ever been able to, you know, raise up about a, you know, 300-man army against us this whole time. And their A Special Forces team sure got away with a big one here, but we'll just kill the other couple hundred of them, and that'll be the end of that. Since they couldn't tell the truth about what had happened, they instead went with, we were minding our own business, they attacked us because we're good and evil hates good, and so we must defend good from evil. And we must tell you lies all day and try to scare the crap out of you all day. And people, they liked it. Come on. See, that's the thing. It's like Chris Hedges says in his plagiarized book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. That war gives people meaning. USA and all that. That's endorphin straight into your bloodstream, man. Sorry to be so reductionist, but people really, you know, they get caught up in stuff. Like, it's us versus them and we're going to get them. Only here was the cognitive dissonance for the Americans. We are living in the most powerful country ever with a, at that time, what, $14 trillion economy and a constitutional sort of system, a kind of law that had lasted. And, man, it would have taken 1,000 September 11ths to really bring down America. 10,000 September 11ths. What are they going to do? Force us all out of all of our cities somehow or something? This gang of pirates, you know? It should have been easier. I guess maybe it wasn't. It finally became, you know, easy enough for Americans to get over it. The fear subsided. But in Israel, it's not like that. In Israel, with the occupation of the West Bank, which after all is not Iraq way on the other side of Jordan from even them, never mind how far it is away from us, but they're right there on the West Bank all the time. They got their settlers right there on the West Bank all the time. They're laying siege to the Gaza Strip. Right there on the beach that they haven't taken for themselves yet. An entire concentration camp full of a couple million refugees. Most of them under the age of 18. And so they got to tell themselves stories all day. More likely, the government has to tell the people of Israel stories all day about how everyone is trying to kill them. Just like every state is based on fear. But in Israel, they're so out of whack that it leads to, as she described, it leads to them licensing themselves to get away with the complete denial of human rights to the occupied Palestinians. They're so caught up in that complex of vaunting and fear that they can't help but use the overwhelming power that they really do have and that they really do know they have against these people that they convince themselves to be so terrified of. And it's wrong. And America pays for it all. And America pays for it all. The American people pay for it all. Inflation pays for it all. And here's another thing, and damn, I'm out of time. I'll just tell you real quick. There's a Washington Post article. You could Google it. Washington Post, Gaza drones. And it's a couple of few years old. And the first half of the article is about how poor little Israel, they can't help themselves, but they have to do this. But then in the second half of the article, they really do talk about what it's like to be a little kid growing up in the Gaza Strip with drones buzzing overhead all day, every day. It might blow you to smithereens, it might not. But really, imagine your kids growing up like that, with enemy drones in the sky all day, their entire life. With no break. Just buzz. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott. All right, so listen up. This is important. This is Max Blumenthal's interview from Liberty Chat. I'm sorry I didn't plug it on the show yesterday, man. I'm doing this every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time at libertychat.com, and they got Kathy something and Adam Kokesh, I think, has a show on there, and a couple other people. It's kind of a new project again, getting it going, libertychat.com, so please join me for the Scott Horton Show on there every Tuesday night at 8. Anyway, so this was my interview last night with Max Blumenthal about, well, what's behind what's going on right now in Israel and Palestine. I think you'll be, well, something.
Well, you know, before we get into the piece, you know, Gaza is being basically carpet bombed as we speak. In the last few hours, over 90 precision-guided missiles have fallen on the Gaza Strip. 32 people are dead. Including all members of an entire family except a 10-year-old boy. The Gaza Strip is in flames, and Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, has authorized rocket launches into Israel of homemade rockets and really outdated, antiquated, Grad-style rockets, which are reaching pretty far. Just one recently hit just south of Tel Aviv, causing zero casualties. These rockets rarely cause any casualties that are not psychological. But you have the biggest escalation, military escalation, since November 2012, when over 200 people in the besieged Gaza Strip were killed by Israeli airstrikes. This is a direct result of Netanyahu and his inner circle and the military intelligence apparatus in Israel milking an extremely dangerous but very contained situation of three missing Israeli teens for all the political propaganda they could get out of it. And it's led directly to racist revenge killings, near pogroms across Israel against Palestinian communities, rioting in Palestinian neighborhoods, the brutal beating of a 15-year-old American boy who was on vacation in East Jerusalem, a Palestinian American who was beaten nearly to death by Israeli police, who is still being held by Israeli police without charges, who the U.S. has not pressured Israel to release. And just to make a long story short, 2 weeks ago, three Israeli teenagers went missing while they were hitchhiking. They were kidnapped, apparently by a rogue Hamas cell. There's no indication there are any orders from Hamas to do this. No one's taken responsibility. And the accused kidnapper, one of them, is from a family with a long history of acting in contravention of Hamas orders. So you have a rogue cell that takes these kids. There is a phone call by one of the kidnapped teens to Israeli police. He called for help. He said, "We've been kidnapped." Gunshots were heard on the phone call. Then the kidnappers can be heard declaring, "We got three of them. We got three," then singing celebratory song. The three kidnapped teens were dead. The parents of the teens were called in by the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service. They were played the phone call, and they said, "What are those gunshot sounds?" The Shin Bet and the Israeli police told them those are blanks, lying to the parents that their teens were dead so that they could use the parents for propaganda value. One of the mothers was even sent to the UN Human Rights Council in Switzerland to plead for international help. A gag order was placed on the Israeli media forbidding them and anyone who reported on it, they could go to jail. So forbidding them from reporting on the investigation, the details, even the gunshots and the phone call. In other words, to trick the Israeli public into believing that the teens were still alive. Within 24 hours, the Israeli police, Shin Bet, and army knew who the two suspected kidnappers were, where they lived, and were combing their homes. That, too, was kept from the Israeli public. Israeli forces rampaged throughout the West Bank, raiding over 15,000 Palestinian homes, arresting over 560 Palestinians, most of whom were remotely affiliated with Hamas. 200 are being held without charges. 6 people were killed. And the entire region or Israel-Palestine was plunged into political chaos. So about a week and a half go by, and the bodies are found. The bodies of the 3 Israeli teens lay in a shallow grave on the property of one of the suspected kidnappers, who the Israeli military intelligence apparatus and Netanyahu had known all along were the suspected kidnappers, were being investigated. They were not even found by Israeli police. They were found by a volunteer team, to show you that just the, how incredibly botched this investigation was and how the manipulation fed into the bungling practices of the police. So the bodies were found. Netanyahu releases an insane statement, completely inflammatory, calling for blood vengeance and invoking pogroms against Jews in turn-of-the-century Europe. Israeli society goes mad. Mobs march into the streets chanting death to Arabs. And a group of young men who met at one of these marches, which were staged all over the country as thousands upon thousands of young Jewish Israelis took to Facebook to call for revenge, to post pictures of themselves with their weapons and their military gear calling for revenge. A group of young men met at one of these marches and decided to look for Palestinian boys to kidnap and kill. They found one in the occupied neighborhood of Shufat in East Jerusalem, forced him to drink gasoline, burned him alive, dumped his body in the woods. Rioting broke out as the Israeli police put a gag order on that investigation and held that boy's body while attempting to implicate his own family in the crime. 6 young Jewish nationalist men have been arrested, and they are the killers. But by now, that's all forgotten. Israel has started bombing the Gaza Strip, claiming that Hamas was responsible. Hamas was responsible for the kidnapped teens. Therefore, all of Hamas will pay, in the words of Netanyahu, who called them in his official statement, human animals. Human animals, leading to this spree of bloodshed. Now, because the Gaza Strip is governed by Hamas, the Israeli Air Force has started bombarding it. Hamas has fired rockets, and the bombing of Gaza has intensified. And here we are in a situation of chaos that shows no sign of ebbing. All the result of political manipulation and incitement from the highest levels of the Israeli government.
Unreal, except for how common it all seems.
And
anyway,
these are established facts on the record, Scott. Right. None of this.
Well, we're going
is
back over
dispute.
To the more controversial ones here in just a second. Let me remind everybody, I'm talking with Max Blumenthal. Here he is at electronicintifada.net. And the article is Netanyahu Government Knew Teens Were Dead as It Whipped Up Racist Frenzy. And again, I'm urging you guys to read this thing. It's, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 words or something. Very well reported piece of work here by Max Blumenthal. I do hope that you guys will find it, read it, pass it around on your social media and all of that kind of thing if you could. You'll want to once you're done reading it, I promise, before you're done. But now, so let me go back over a few of these facts just to make sure you have a chance to actually establish them here. When it comes to, and this is just in the order of my notes, not importance or anything here. When it comes to the known, your certainty that they knew the boys were dead. It wasn't just that you can prove that they had heard the 911 call or its equivalent, right? The call of the police recording with the gunshots in it. But it's the fact that they lied to the parents and said that somehow they knew that that those were blanks. And then, of course, denied any evidence of actual bullets or bullet wounds. Say, for example, like blood in the car, that kind of thing. The fact that they lied. Is there any other thing that's leading you to your certainty that they, I mean, that's pretty strong evidence, don't get me wrong, but do you have anything else on they had to have known the boys were dead by that point?
Well, the lying to the parents was shocking.
Yeah. All right, now, hold right there. We'll be right back, y'all, with more of this Max Blumenthal interview from yesterday. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket-sized print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm playing the interview that I recorded with Max Blumenthal last night. Well, it played live on Liberty Chat. Anyway, he writes for Mondo Weiss and for Electronic Intifada, and we're talking about his Electronic Intifada piece here. And so here, to pick up where we left off. Is there any other thing that's leading you to your certainty that they, I mean, that's pretty strong evidence, don't get me wrong, but do you have anything else on they had to have known the boys were dead by that point?
Well, the lying to the parents was shocking.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredible.
And the refusal to even prepare, emotionally prepare the Israeli public for the possibility that they might be dead was the most dangerous part. Because they set the Israeli public up to believe that the boys would be released in some kind of prisoner exchange, as Gilad Shalit was. And then when they were given the news that they were actually dead, it was like a jolt to this very tribal, closely knit society. And it led to directly to the revenge spree. So I'm saying they didn't even make an effort to allow the Israeli public to consider the possibility that these teens might have been dead when all of the evidence to about a 99% certainty that they were dead, from the phone call to the lying to the parents to the simple fact that the Shin Bet, Israel's intelligence, the General Security Service, has the West Bank under lock and key. It knows what's happening in every corner of the West Bank. It has collaborators, Palestinian collaborators, completely honeycombed through every hen house, flop house, outhouse, and coffee house, and was able to zero in on any Hamas member it wanted to and arrest them in their bed, but it couldn't simply determine that these teens were nowhere to be found because they had been buried. Mm-hmm. So it really is mind-boggling that this was some kind of mistake. The Israeli government has also admitted that it knew who the suspects were within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But when
and
it
you
did
say they
so,
found bullets and blood in the car, and when did they find the car? Right away?
The car was found right away, and this is reported, a burned, stolen car was found right away, and the Israeli police denied, told the parents that no DNA was found in the car, when in fact bullets and blood were found in the car. Mm-hmm. Right, if bullets and blood are found in the car, that means that they are probably dead or extremely wounded.
And then later you say they admitted that they knew all along the identity of their two prime suspects, or they admitted all along that they knew the identity of their two primes. Oh, it was because they raided their houses right away was how that leaked, right?
Well, I was able to determine the names of the suspects through Palestinian media, through Arabic language media, which was not subject to the gag order. The families had gone to Arabic language media and said, our houses are being raided, they're coming for our sons. The mother of one of the suspects, Marwan Kowasme, said, well, if he did it, I'm proud of him, and I hope he gets away. So there was not even an attempt to deny that they were gone. Their names had been given to the Israelis by the Palestinian Authority, which coordinates its security with the Israeli army and is basically an arm of the Israeli occupation. It's basically the Bantustan Authority. So this information was basically whitewashed out of the Israeli media or prevented from reaching the Israeli public by the gag order. And, you know, in a normal criminal investigation in this country, if a suspect is wanted for a high crime, their posters appear everywhere in every post office. They'll be on TV even. And the police will give press conferences announcing their names and asking the public to help find them. In Israel, what happened in an incredibly abnormal society was the opposite. Their names were concealed from the Israeli public so that the public could believe that they could be anywhere in the West Bank among any Hamas cell to justify the military escalation. And Hamas was blamed, the entire organization. Although the organization had no knowledge of the kidnapping, took no responsibility for it, and really has a very tenuous relationship with the two men who are accused.
And yeah, now let me get back to that too. That's a very important point. You say it's this rogue faction, but it's not just that, oh yeah, three different people use the term rogue faction. You actually know a thing or two about this breakoff group, basically, of Hamas. You say they have a history of screwing things up for Hamas.
Yes, Shlomi Eldar, who is an Israeli reporter, a veteran Israeli correspondent, who's covered Hamas and the Palestinian Authority for about 20, 30 years, wrote a piece for Al Monitor about the history of the Kowasme clan and their role in attacks that were carried out during ceasefires between Hamas and Israel during the Second Intifada, and how Hamas leadership privately condemned the attacks in phone calls to the Israeli government and said, we had nothing to do with these suicide attacks. We were trying to honor the ceasefire. The Israelis would then use the opportunity to assassinate major Hamas leaders, which, you know, suggests that,
raises questions, doesn't it? Yeah.
Raises serious questions. I mean, let's just say that in the 1970s, there was a figure named Abu Nidal, who was probably the world's most prominent Palestinian terrorist. And in his hijackings and killings, besides the hijackings and killings that he was known for, he mostly killed Palestinians who were from rival factions. He mostly carried out attacks during ceasefires, and he was widely suspected of being a Mossad agent. So, and it's pretty well established that he was. So there is precedent for that. I'm not saying these men were agents of the Shin Bet or Mossad. It's just that this attack, this kidnapping occurred at an extremely suspicious time, right after Fatah and Hamas signed a unity deal, which both factions were celebrating and which the U.S. recognized. So the U.S. de facto recognized the legitimacy of Hamas, and Netanyahu went crazy. He had a conniption fit and wanted to find a way of fracturing the unity deal. So let's just say this was a moment of opportunity for Netanyahu, and he wasn't going to let it go to waste.
Yeah. All right. And now, in the scheme of things, compared to what you just said about, you know, the global politics and all this, this is back to the microscope. But it's just so outrageous, this spin that the boy that was lynched and did you say, made to drink gasoline before being set alight, that they blamed his own parents for his murder?
The Israeli police leaked information through the Israeli media that Mohammed Abu Khuder, who was killed in a revenge crime by Jewish terrorists, was gay and was killed by his family in an honor crime. Absolutely zero evidence, which is consistent with the Israeli government's deployment of the tactic of pinkwashing, where they present themselves as this haven for LGBT rights, for gay rights in the Middle East, and they paint their enemies as haters of gays in order to appeal to liberals who might otherwise be disgusted by the Israeli occupation and human rights abuses. And in this case, they attempted to deploy that tactic in order to deflect blame from their own society for the killing of this young boy. And these kind of killings, these lynchings, which recall the lynching of Emmett Till in this country, are not uncommon. This is just one of the first times we've seen it reported in our mainstream media. In my book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, I detail numerous lynchings which were carried out almost in the same place and by the same kind of character, products of the Israeli education system and its culture of militarization. Lynchings of young Palestinian men in Jerusalem. And this is, you know, this is a fact of life in Israel today. It's a fact of the status quo. And you say this is, you know, a microscope. We're looking at it through a microscope. We are looking at it through a microscope. But where we're standing is in the United States. While we look in that microscope, we're standing in the benefactor of this occupation, the benefactor of apartheid. And it's the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, which is responsible for all the hideous bacteria and toxins that we're viewing under that microscope right now.
Yep. Well, and see, that's the thing, man, is, you know, I'm not one for negotiating with terrorists. And so the fact that Osama bin Laden and his hijacker pilots constantly cited Israel as part of their motivation for attacking the United States and just getting, you know, round two of the terror war started back 13 years ago now. It would just be an interesting piece of trivia if what they hated about Israel was nice little Israel minding its own business, and these guys are just basically a bunch of Arab Nazis who can't leave Israel alone because of just how much they hate Jews for no reason or some kind of thing. Well, then screw them. I guess we have to fight them. Except that's not what's going on here. They've cited the crimes of Israel, what any honest, decent, objective person can describe as the immoral behavior of the Israeli government and what it does to the people in the occupation. At the time of 9/11, they included the occupation of Lebanon, of course.
All right, music's playing. We got to go. Too.
That whole thing will be at scotthorton.org/interviews and at libertychat.com. I don't think it's there yet, but should be up by this afternoon or tonight. We'll be right back. Eric Margolies next. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
You started this damn war. Now you have to deal with it.
And we will. It is just a matter of time before we achieve a complete victory.
You know there won't be a victory. Every day your war machines lose ground to a bunch of poorly armed, poorly equipped freedom fighters. The fact is that you underestimated your competition. If you'd studied your history, you'd know that these people have never given up to anyone. They'd rather die than be slaves to an invading army. You can't defeat a people like that. We tried. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours.
Have you not seen enough death? Go. Go while you can. This is not your war.
It is now.
What you see here are the Mujahideen soldiers.
All right.
Holy warriors. To us, this war is a holy war.
It's kind of fun.
And there's no true death for the Mujahideen because we have taken our last rites and we consider ourselves dead already. To us, death for our land and God is an honor.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first two clips are much better. Of course, all that's from Rambo 3, which was on last night. The clip about America baiting the Soviets into their Vietnam and all of that. But that last one is actually most interesting because that's Massoud, the Mujahideen leader being portrayed in Rambo 3 there. He's a guy that, according to our next guest, Eric Margolies, was actually KGB all along and was only pretending to fight and wasting CIA resources. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Hello, Scott. I'm just fine. Thank you.
I'm just killing time playing Rambo 3 clips, and they're directly relevant to your journalism. What do you know about that? Tell us about Massoud real quick, even though that's not why I have you on the show today.
Massoud was a tribal, ethnic Tajik tribal leader from a northern region in Afghanistan called the Panjshir Valley, a major drug production area. And Massoud had been to university or attended university in Paris, and the French caught on to him, and they loved him because he could speak some French. And he, French media christened him the Lion of the Panjshir Valley. And he portrayed himself as a heroic Mujahideen fighting the Soviet invaders after the 1979 invasion. He was adulated and idolized in the West. In fact, he was a big-time traitor to the Afghans. He had been a KGB asset for a long time. Had gotten to him, I think, when he was in Paris. And he was working quietly with the KGB. And when the Soviets invaded, what he did was he pretended to be fighting and attacking the Soviet forces, when in fact he was not. He was spending his time fighting the real Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets. I knew this because I was there at the time. And we kept saying, well, I can't understand why, who's attacking us? Why are our troops being frustrated? Why can't we blow up the Salang Tunnel? Well, it was Massoud's doing. And he was positioning himself with the Soviets, trying to make himself to be the head of Afghanistan to replace the Soviet leader, Soviet-selected leader Najibullah. But this didn't happen because two of Osama bin Laden's men, remember, Osama bin Laden was primarily an anti-communist crusader. They went and they blew him up, and that was the end of Massoud. But his supporters in the form of what's called the Northern Alliance and the Tajiks are still very prominent today.
Under America's protection.
American protection, because as soon as the Americans decided to invade Afghanistan, they bought the Tajik forces and the Uzbek forces in the north, who had been collaborating with the Soviets. They were paid tens of millions of dollars. They switched their allegiance to the U.S. and they served as the spearhead for the U.S. invasion forces.
Hey, tell me this, and I don't know if you've ever reported this or if it's just a matter of speculation, Eric, but do you think that Vladimir Putin and them were thinking, haha, now we're baiting you right back into the very same our Vietnam again, you idiots? Go ahead and invade. Because after all, I mean, I know there was a political fight. He had to face down the right-wingers in Russia and say, no, it's the right thing to help the Americans right now, which makes sense on its face, but also in a sneaky kind of way. That's the best way to overextend and break an empire is to lure them into Afghanistan, am I right?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Scott. I've never really understood Putin's motives for giving so much help to the U.S., you know, opening supply lines through the north, giving them intelligence information, giving them help with the Soviet-backed Tajiks and Uzbeks, and the KGB there. I think Putin hates Muslims. He's a visceral anti-Islamist. Look at his, the way he crushed the Chechen resistance and the Caucasus. He's really very alarmed by this whole Caucasus issue. So he figured, well, you know, we'll help the American devils to crush the Afghan Islamist devils. The Afghans are a bigger priority. That's my reasoning.
Well, and it would have made sense for him to assume that the Americans are too smart to go ahead and try to just stay forever, because what are you going to do, remake their entire society with a government in a box or something?
Sure. Well, the Americans are, what, 50,000 American troops are in Japan since 1945, and 38,000 in Korea, not to mention all over Asia and different parts of the world. There's still American troops in Germany.
Well, sure, but he would have known that the Afghans would have kicked our asses out, though, over the long term, the same way they kicked the Russians out before us, right?
Well, that's what the Russians have been warning the Americans all along. It's quite right. But on the other hand, tactically, I guess it suited Putin to cooperate with the states, help them with their problem in Afghanistan, just the way he helped the U.S. out of the Syrian mess when Obama and his warrior female advisors boxed themselves into a corner there.
Yeah. I was just thinking maybe there was a chance he had read Zbigniew Brzezinski and thought, you know, that guy was pretty clever what he did to us. And so,
well, I interviewed Brzezinski on that very subject. Brzezinski claimed in 1979 that he had staged an uprising in Afghanistan purposely to lure the Soviets in. I don't believe him. I think that he's taking far too much credit, and it's sort of adjusting history after the facts. And Brzezinski is a brilliant man. I have great respect for him, but he's got one blind spot, and that's Russia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being Polish, he doesn't see clearly when it comes to Russia, but I think he's over-exaggerated his role.
Yeah, well, he certainly celebrated, though, probably, right? I mean, they say there's the memo where he said, now we'll give them their own Vietnam and all of that. No, you think that whole thing's a myth?
I think it's wildly over-exaggerated.
Yeah, I could see that. And what a brilliant move. And then, but he's left defending the creation of the or at least, you know, having a lot to do with spurring on this entire Mujahideen movement across the Middle East. And so then he has to make excuses for September 11th. Well, you know, we did bring down the Soviet Union and all of that, so.
That's true. Well, it wasn't just the Americans. It wasn't just Brzezinski. I remember 1981 or 82, I was invited to Beijing, China, when it was still very much red China. And I was asked to be invited by the Chinese Institute of Strategic Studies, which was a think tank portion of Chinese military intelligence. And what they wanted to talk to me about was whether they should support the Mujahideen and open up supply lines to them of weapons.
And what did you say?
I said, yes, by all means. I said, don't waste any time. Get with it. And
hey, I'm sorry. We got to take this stupid break here because that's just how it goes. But you know this interview is going to go overtime today because we got so much to talk about Iraq. But I'm glad I asked about my Rambo 3 clips I was killing time with there because this has been interesting.
Okay, so. Scott.
Hang on 1 minute, everybody. Eric Margulies on the line. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, lourockwell.com, unz.com, that's UNZ, unz.com, and lots of great articles on everything wrong in the damn world. And as you can tell, I surprise him with a question about the Afghan war from 20 years ago, and he'll tell you the answer. All right, now, if it's all right, I want to change the subject to Iraq and what all is going on there. I think I'd like to start with your impression of the new self-proclaimed caliph, the video and the sermon that he gave last Friday and his, I guess, you know, big first coming out ceremony since declaring the new caliphate between the land formerly known as Iraq and I guess what's now the rump state of Western Syria. What do you think?
Well, if you remember the old movie, The Mouse That Roared, about the Grand Duchy of Fenwick declaring war on the U.S., Peter Sellers' movie, this was like the camel that roared. But, it's a very, this ISIS is a very relatively small organization. I don't think it has more than 8,000 fighters, no heavy equipment, and it's only in Sunni areas of Iraq and Syria. But it's certainly a grandiose pronouncement for a ragtag rebel group. I am surprised that there's been no effort until now to proclaim a caliphate, except, mind you, there wasn't in Afghanistan. The Taliban, when it was ruling Afghanistan, declared an Islamic caliphate in Afghanistan until it was crushed by U.S. forces. This is another attempt to erase or to change the borders in the Middle East that were created by Western colonialists.
All right, now, I guess the question is, because I don't know how many thousands of guys they got, but it seems like it's, you know, probably not too many more than 10,000 or so, although there must be some new recruits and that kind of thing going on. But they've got oil and they've got some money, maybe, you know, some billions. Do you think it's likely that they'll get more powerful from here? Because the question still remains, even if it's a pretty damn weak state for a state, is there anyone really powerful enough to oppose them at this point?
Oh, I think so. The ISIS rebels are surrounded by enemies. They've got Syria on one hand, and to the north they've got the Kurds, who are being used by the U.S. as their so local gendarmes. There's the Shia government in Baghdad, and backing them up is Iran, of course, which just sent some warplanes to Baghdad. And finally, there's the other Arab states who are worried. And let me throw in Egypt as well, because the semi-fascist government that's now in power in Egypt has been muttering about actually helping the Iraqi government to make sure that Sunni rebels don't get into power.
Mm-hmm. Well, it still seems like, you know, Assad hasn't been able to, certainly they haven't been able to overthrow him, but he hasn't really been able to take the eastern part of the country back from these guys in, what, 3 years? And does Maliki even have an army to reinvade Mosul? So, in other words, they sure are hemmed in as hell, no doubt about that, beset, surrounded by enemies on all sides. But who's putting together an army to go against them and dislodge them?
Listen, I was just in New York yesterday, and, bridges are falling down, roads are full of potholes, people are begging in the streets because there isn't enough money to bring New York up to at least European standards of maintenance. But we just blew, who knows, $20 billion, $25, $30 billion supposedly training and equipping the Iraqi army, and now we're spending large sums of money equipping and financing the Ukrainian army. We love these little wars overseas, but they're totally non-productive. We can't go on affording this.
All right, now, so I wonder what would happen if, I mean, because I don't know, Eric, I mean, what the hell is going on anyway? They said, I know you're in New York, not D.C., but they've sent armed drones. They've sent helicopters. I don't mean to sound like Shepard Smith before the Iraq war crying that it hadn't started yet. It's not that. It's just that I am a little dumbfounded that it hasn't started yet. I would love to stop it any way I could, because I'm foreseeing the bad consequences. That's actually the question I was trying to get to. They
well,
say
Washington,
that they're sending helicopters and drones, but it seems to me like whatever bad happens to ISIS, we want it to be any of those other powers you just named fault, not ours.
Well, we're doing what we did in Libya. Remember, that sort of leading from behind and trying to get other people to do the dirty work, because we don't want to be seen to do it. But look, Washington is also trying to kick Maliki out. He's been a non-responsive puppet, or a puppet gone astray, sort of like Karzai in Kabul, and they're looking for a more acceptable general or somebody, or God knows, maybe even Ahmed Chalabi, the fraudster who helped lead us into the last war in Iraq. Once they get this done, there are more U.S. drones and aircraft and unmarked aircraft flying over the area, and the Kurds are sending troops south. And look, you know, you look on the map, and it looks like ISIS has these huge territories that it controls, but actually most of this area is just deserts. And the only thing that counts in that area are the river valleys. And, yeah, they control the river valleys and the small towns almost as far south as Baghdad, but not a lot more.
Yeah. Well, but leading for behind, I mean, what's going to happen? The Iranian army is going to come in and take over, back up the Sadr's, the Mahdi army and the Badr Brigade. But these guys can't take Mosul. I mean, or maybe they could, but then they would have a hardcore insurgency. They'd never pacify. I mean, maybe Iran's full army, but they're not going to do it. Who's America going to hire to do this?
Well, the U.S. made clear it doesn't want Iranian ground forces, and the Israelis have also made that clear, and the Saudis and the Gulf Arabs are hysterical at the thought of Iranian troops coming into Iraq for a second time, I might add.
So is America going to end up saying, okay, well, I guess there's a bin Ladenite state, but, you know, big deal. I mean, I would prefer that, but I don't really see. It seems like at some point they're just going to start the carpet bombing and send in the Marines, because who else is going to send in their Marines?
Well, Washington may be able to cobble together enough mercenaries. Don't worry, we have about 5,000 mercenary troops in Iraq now. What they did, these are non-uniformed, semi-uniformed fighters and technicians who run the air bases that are still there. They'll send some more special forces in. They can get enough troops. There are the Turks, potentially, who could provide some troops, special forces troops. And, of course, the Kurds, as I've been saying. So these are a bunch of guys in pickup trucks.
Right.
This is not a major fighting force.
All right. Let me keep you one more segment, please.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks. More with Eric Margulies on Iraq right after this. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margulies. Thanks for holding on for us and doing another segment here, Eric. So the question is about the regime change in Baghdad, and I guess America and Sistani seems, I guess his language is sometimes kind of vague on the issue. Seems like Sistani and America are agreed on regime change. Iran is still sticking with Maliki, is that right? Do you know?
Well, I think the Iranians, being Iranians, are playing all sides and are being cautious. Iran can't be seen helping America overthrow a Muslim Middle East government. So they have to move very slowly. And Maliki, and it was a long time ally of the Iranians. So they're cautious. Back in 2002, when the U.S. was getting ready to overthrow Saddam Hussein the following year, I said, once the U.S. overthrows Saddam, they're going to have to find another Saddam, because they're going to find that's the only person who can really run Iraq. And such is the case now.
Well, it seems like the policy is we got to find, you mentioned Chalabi, we'll find Chalabi or Alawi or somebody who can, I guess, divert enough. I even saw a warmonger in the Washington Post, I thought, make a pretty good argument, not for intervention, but just that. And then what? They're going to bribe all the Sunni population and go about the policy, all the benchmark reconciliation policy from 2007 that never was accomplished back then. And now, after all this, they're going to hold Iraq together by bribing all the Sunni tribal chiefs to do another awakening movement, turn on the ISIS guys and marginalize them, and then hold Iraq together and all will be great. That sounds stupid. That sounds so impossible that it couldn't possibly be what's going to happen here.
Which is probably exactly what's going to happen, because the U.S. is bankrupt on policy. It doesn't know what else to do. One of the problems is that you can see this in Kabul, Afghanistan today, with squabbling so-called presidential candidates in a rigged election. And even that is a disaster. They're all from CIAU. These guys, and yes, the Washington can't even run a proper rigged election there. Same thing will happen in Baghdad. They're going to have to find some guy out of CIAU. You mentioned Chalabi or some of these other characters, Alawi, but Washington will never go and look for an authentic leader who has some kind of legitimate roots. Just these guys in business suits who speak perfect English and a manicured fingernails, not what the area needs.
Right. Well, and this is the thing. You know, I read this thing in the Washington Post where the guy was an advisor to Petraeus and to Crocker and all these people, and, you know, speaks Arabic and is some smart, credentialed guy or whatever. And he's talking about learning things in 2010 that I was learning from the likes of you and Robert Dreyfus and Patrick Coburn and others as far back as like 2004, about how, you know, among the Shiites, the only leader with any real power and credibility in Iraq who wants to hold the country together, who's willing to really share power with the Sunnis and make friends and rally around nationalism as a way to prevent civil war, was Sadr. But he was some scumbag with grease under his fingernails to the Americans. And they instead sided with the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party, who've been living in hotels in Iran all along, right? Who are these manicured fingernail guys that you're talking about. But how the major difference then between Sadr and them was they meant all along, and Sadr denounced them all along, the whole war long, Eric, that their policy was to just take, get America to give them Baghdad and kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and then take all the land from Baghdad to Basra and screw the rest of the country. They were just going to strong federalism, they called it. But what it meant, it was like Biden's three-state plan. That was what Iran wanted, and that was what America accomplished for them.
And up in the north, the Kurds have set up their own independent states.
Is it really true, though, that the guys that are advising Petraeus are really only learning these things that Bob Dreyfus was telling me 6 years later,
well,
when they're the ones running
the
damn war?
You mentioned Crocker, who was Ambassador Crocker. He was a senior spokesman for the administration. He was an idiot, and he knew nothing. But he was sent as a supreme cheerleader to tell the American media how well things were going and things were in democracy and education and all this baloney like that. These are people who have no training, no background, no sense of history. No knowledge of anything ethnic in the country's background.
Yeah, and then didn't want to learn. I mean, hell, I didn't have it all worked out either. I knew that Bush had, you know, lured, you know, kind of, you know, did a Bay of Pigs thing with the Shia in 91 and urged them and the Kurds to rise up and then had left them stranded. But I didn't have it all wired. But hey, once America, you know, broke it and bought it and occupied it and owned it, it seemed worth figuring out, you know, who runs the Badr Brigade and what their objectives are. You know, why not? I don't know. Seemed interesting.
Know, Scott, I've been in Washington plenty of times with senior officials, with congressmen, and I've tried to explain these things about Afghanistan and about Iraq, and they just they don't have the mental time to try and understand. They don't want to know about it. They're still struggling to figure out what happened to Bosnia and Herzegovina. What the hell happened to Herzegovina? Where are the Herzegovinians? Are they allied to the Russians now? They've disappeared. So we've reached a knowledge saturation because we're fighting too many little wars and skirmishes around the world, and nobody has time to learn all this stuff except a few cranks like me.
Yeah, well, believe me, I can't keep up, not by a long shot. That's why I've got you, thank God. But, okay, so now the Peshmerga, they've bitten off a lot in saying we're keeping Kirkuk forever, that's it. You think they're moving beyond that border, or they're just, their fight is to protect their hills and now Kirkuk too?
Well, Kirkuk was really their big prize, the major oil center. And it's, by the way, it's a short drive from the Turkish border. And let me tell you, and I've been saying this for years, that the Turks are watching all this going on, saying these oil fields used to be part of the Ottoman Empire until the rapacious British imperialists drew a line and took our oil away. Why shouldn't we have it back? So that's an issue. The Kurds are really feeling their beans, and they are being helped extensively by the United States and Israel. Israel is a major player in the whole Kurdish question. In fact, the Kurds have built a pipeline that goes up to Turkey, and from Turkey, it's being shipped by sea to Israel. So the Israelis have got themselves a new source of oil. They've armed the Kurds since 1970. So there's lots of footsie and hanky-panky going on there.
Well, and they've declared a referendum. It's on now. They've locked down Kirkuk, and they're declaring independence in a matter of months, no?
Well, they're declaring what's already de facto. And the big question is, how will Turkey and Iran, both of whom have large Kurdish minorities, react to the situation? Interesting, the Turks in the past would have sent their army in. But now the Turks are making an accommodation with their own Kurds, and we'll probably take a much more relaxed view to the emergence of an independent Kurdistan.
You know, we never do hear much about the Iranian Kurds and their relationship with the Iraqi Kurds other than, you know, Hirsch's report a few years back about CIA support for PJAC in Iran.
Yeah, that's quite right. We hear absolutely nothing. I'm not aware of any close links between them. But Kurds traditionally have been divided along tribal and clan lines. What is amazing is that the Kurdish mini-state in northern Iraq has held together for so long because its two principal tribal factions, the Talibanis and the Barzanis, have been feuding since the dawn of time.
All right. And with that, I got to let you go. Here, man, I just remembered, too, I wanted to ask you about the Houthi rebellion in northern Yemen, but that'll have to wait for another day. Thank you so
much
for your time.
Next time, Scott, I'm following it, though.
I sure appreciate your time again, Eric.
Cheers, Scott.
Eric Margolis, everybody. Spelled like Margolis. EricMargolis.com. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So that was the great Eric Margolis. And yeah, that is a big deal. There's a Houthi rebellion in northern Yemen where the Shia live. They've been fighting for a while. Let's see, I got the Jason Ditz article here about it. Shiite fighters seize North Yemen city, at least 200 killed. Loss of provincial capital, a major blow to Hadi government. Shiite Houthi rebels, Hadi is the one man on the ballot elected dictator of Yemen. Hillary Clinton praised the democracy. Shiite Houthi rebels from northern Yemen have seized the city of Amran, the provincial capital of the Amran governorate, and a walled city just 32 miles from the capital city of Sana. Intense fighting against a Sunni Islamist tribal faction left the Houthis in control of Amran, and at least 200 people confirmed killed since the latest round of fighting began over the weekend. Houthi spokesman declared the takeover a victory for the underprivileged sons of Amran and denied having any interest in using the city as a staging ground for advancing on Sana itself. Whether that's true or not, the Hadi government and its predecessors have been openly backing the Sunni Islamists against the Houthi for decades, and the sense of defeat is palpable. Having trouble talking today. And the sense of defeat is palpable. Yemen has been fighting these on-again, off-again wars with the Houthis, primarily at the behest of the Saudi government, as the Houthis rarely venture outside their comparatively unimportant and only almost wholly undeveloped northwestern region. Their primary grievance is that the Yemeni government has discriminated against them in modernization project. Hey, everybody just wants on the dole, man. Come off with some of that national income. That's the answer to the tweet just now. Why would anybody pay $35,000 to see a Chelsea Clinton speech so that she can help them get access to the treasury later? That's why. Stop pretending you don't know that. The New Republic, the founders of crony capitalism in America. Well, okay, I mean, they were put up by J.P. Morgan in the first place to get us into World War I, so, okay? Why in the world would somebody just hand $35,000 to Chelsea Clinton for no apparent reason? Is she a stockbroker? Is she a bank teller? Is she a boat salesman? One day she'll be a politician and then she will help you steal from others. That's why. To give money to Chelsea Clinton. Same kind of thing. The Houthis, man, they just want some of that public till. No, I don't know what all. I'm sure they're horribly and terribly oppressed and always have been. But anyway, so that's going on. And this is the kind of thing that is our business because of the American Empire. because the government of Yemen is a wholly owned subsidiary of the government of the United States. It's a satellite of American full spectrum, whatever metaphor and simile and all that. They work for us. The dictatorship there works for us. So that means whatever the dictatorship does to the local people there, it reflects badly on us. Let's put it that way. And by all accounts, American intervention in Yemen, especially in the Obama years, has just been absolute catastrophe. Has done nothing but expand the terror war in every way. And you hear the resignation in Eric Margolies' voice when explains that, yeah, these people with the power, they really are completely stupid. I remember it was David Gregory, of all people, on Meet the Press, asked Leon Panetta when he was the head of the CIA, or maybe he was the head of the DOD at the time, either way. And Gregory said to him, hey man, so here we are, more than a decade after September 11th, and I finally heard of the word consequences. And I'm starting to wonder, is it possible? I know it's crazy, but just hear me out. Is it possible that you're actually just creating more enemies with the horrible things you're doing to the enemies that you already created for yourself? Oh, he didn't ask the question that well, but that was sort of the basis. Okay, they started it, but are we making it worse with these drone strikes, he asks. And Panetta says, hey, listen, these are the tools we have, and so these are the tools that we'll use. What do you want us to do, not drone these guys? We gotta drone them. Okay, there you go. Just keep digging that hole. It's good for Raytheon, and it's good for congressmen who get paid by Raytheon. And that's about all. I guess the banks that service the transfers of wealth from the government to Raytheon, they get a cut. So that's pretty good. And I guess people who invest in Raytheon, they get their dividend checks so that they can go on vacation. So that's nice for them. But the people in Yemen, they get exploded to death. And you and I, we get it taken right out of our paycheck. So it seems like really it's most people on both sides are getting the bad end of the deal. And I don't think there's any journalism out of Yemen that says, yeah, you know, your drone war is really working. There's fewer and fewer Al-Qaeda every day. Every time you blow someone up, you don't kill any innocent people, you don't make anybody mad, and nobody joins up a movement that's dedicated to trying to figure out a way to kill you someday. I mean, I guess what we have going for us is that we can send our remote control planes there to kill them, but they don't have the ability to fight back against us. They try to put a bomb in a package on a plane, some idiot's underwear, and try to get lucky is all they can do. But then again, they could get lucky. Men like them have before. And you know, one thing I didn't really get a chance to get into with Margulies is, okay, so maybe ISIS is not that bad of a threat, but what if they lose? Oh, I guess I did ask him. I don't know. What if they lose and it's because America drone bombed the hell out of them? And they turn their whole war into an anti-American one. And al-Baghdadi says, Bin Laden was right. We gotta get the Americans first. And then they start attacking us. How dangerous of a threat is that? I know Giraldi told me, oh, Scott Horton, chill out. Which, you know what, I would just shut up and listen to him. But on the other hand, like, hey, man, some of these guys got Western passports. They've gone to fight now in Syria. They've made friends with some of these kooks. If their policy changed to let's try to attack America, seems like they could probably get a few through. But then again, you know what? It's been a long time since we had a serious-ass terrorist attack in America, or even a real serious-ass attempt. I don't know. Times Square, Detroit. I guess Zazi, right, the guy from Denver. But that's about it. None of those were, even if they'd been successful, well, I don't know. If Detroit had been successful, that would have been really something else. Blowing up a plane in midair over a major city. That could have been huge. Anyway, for the most part, I ain't trying to scaremonger. other than, unless, I guess, if I can scaremonger you into being anti-war, that, hey, here's a whole brand new hornet's nest that's attempting to consolidate itself. We don't need to be the ones to go knock it over. As Margulies said, look, the Kurds are going to hate these guys. They're surrounded by enemies. They got the Kurds, the Turks, the Syrians, the Iraqis, backed by the Iranians, and even all the Arab states are terrified of these guys, too. Jordan and Saudi and Egypt. So, yeah, you know what? Let Jordan and Saudi and Egypt, that's probably the best thing to do, is tell the Saudis, hey, before these guys start setting off suicide bombs in Riyadh, it's time for you to get in this thing. Let them do it. You set the Iranians and the Shiite Iraqis against them. You just help make it a worse religious war. Sectarian war, not religious war. Sectarian war. We don't want that. Oh, and hell, I was going to talk about the NSA thing. You know what? I'll talk about the NSA thing tomorrow. I'll interview somebody about it. I thought it was a pretty important story. It's not quite what we were all expecting from the next big Greenwald story, but still, it's pretty damn good. I don't know, pretty important. Shows some criminal-type lawless things. Again, I'll try to have a good guest on about that for you tomorrow, but I'll end with this. When they talk about legalizing pot in Washington State, the frame on TV is always, oh, people getting high. Oh, people getting high. Oh, you're like teenagers. Oh, everyone's getting high and acting a fool and this kind of thing. And okay, they're right. More people probably now going ahead and trying it or whatever. And a little bit of that. But that's not what's important. What's important is people are no longer in Washington State, will no longer have their lives destroyed just for having some pot or just for trading in some pot. And that's huge. The government has been way out of line in persecuting people involved in this for too long. So it's hugely important.